Good morning and welcome. You're tuned in to 2SER 107.3 and it's that time of a Saturday morning. It's Final Draft, Books, Writing and Literary Culture, and I'm your host, Andrew Popel. It has been really full-on interesting couple of weeks here at the station. Thank you to everyone who called up during Supporter Drive. Your support, and it was an amazing Supporter Drive, I just have to say that. You are all so generous. Your support has helped us to keep doing what we do, which is make amazing independent radio, bringing it to your airwaves, but also to your computers and podcasts and all sorts of things. And yeah, just a huge thanks to everyone who called up and contributed, who told me that you love Final Draft. If you still want to donate, you can go to 2SER.com/donate. And your ongoing contributions really make such a huge difference to what we do. But we're back. We're back for normal Final Draft, which means books and writing and literary culture. What a week for writing and literary culture. It's been both good and bad, maybe a little bit sad, I'd have to say. I want to start, I guess, huge congratulations to George Saunders, the American author, took out the Booker Prize this week for his novel Lincoln in the Bardo. I read it earlier this year. He was out for Sydney Writers Festival. It's well worth checking out. It is a well-deserving winner. If you want to find out a little bit more about Lincoln in the Bardo, you can actually go to 2SER.com. Nick Healy and I, Nick Healy from 2SER Breakfast, had a conversation for our regular Tuesday book club. So look up Tuesday Book Club on 2SER.com and you can find out a little bit more about Lincoln in the Bardo, George Saunders' book. It was the winner of this year's Booker Prize. Now, also this week, there was, I guess, a huge controversy and outcry after it was the beginning of the HSC. So the English exam is traditionally the first exam in the HSC, and one of the questions was on a poem called Mangoes by Australian poet Ellen Van Nieuwen. And what happened was basically after the exam, a lot of students got onto a Facebook group set up for HSC students and started making critical comments that very quickly took on a racist tone. So Ellen Van Nieuwen is an Aboriginal woman, and the attacks on her attacked both her art and her as a person. Really horrendous stuff that seems to have exposed, once again, underlying racism that does exist in this country. But I felt like it also highlighted the way we engage with art and literature. Many, many fantastic writers have been engaging with the ideas around racism that were brought out by these comments, but I wanted to just talk quickly about that engagement with art and literature, because Ellen is also a fantastic award-winning novelist. She's also a poet, and I think it speaks to the way we engage with art and the role that we think art occupies in our society, that we feel that we should attack people because we don't agree or we don't understand their art. This is a topic that I've spent a lot of time thinking about this week. I've read Ellen's poem. I think it's an absolute fantastic work that involves a lot of perspective and lyricism to evoke a particular state of mind and a particular joy. It's a really fantastic poem, and I loved it. I encourage you to read it. You may not love it, but I would hope that you wouldn't attack the poem or attack the author simply because you didn't understand it. This is something that I want to continue to follow up and hopefully bring you a little bit more information on in the coming weeks. But I wanted to mention it, and I wanted to encourage everyone both to read Ellen Van Nieuwen's poem Mangoes, but also all the reading that you do with an open and critical mind. You don't have to agree with it. You don't even have to like it, but you should respect it. Artists do so much for our culture. Literature does so much for us becoming who we are. When we talk about Australian culture, we forget sometimes that so much of it has to do with Australian writers. Now, it's been quite a bit of the show going so far, and I haven't even talked about what's coming up. I have two fantastic conversations today, both with a bit of a supernatural theme, both brand new Australian authors. Award-winning novelist Chris Womersley will be talking to me about his latest City of Crows, taking us back to France in the 17th century. It is a fantastic book from Chris. He has been on Final Draft before. I've also got the latest sensation in young adult fiction, Jessica Townsend. She is everywhere right now. You can't walk past a bookshop without seeing her new novel, Nevermore. And we're going to be discovering the land of Nevermore in my conversation with Jessica. It's coming up on Final Draft today. I'm so excited to be bringing this to you and just sharing books with you. You're on 2SER 107.3. I'm Andrew Popel. Just a short break, and then I'm back with the books.
On foot or by bike, get ready to immerse yourself in light and entertainment in the heart of the city on October 28. For one night only, Mrs. Macquarie's Road will be closed to cars and open for people to walk or ride past light installations, special effects and some Halloween surprises. There's also an outdoor lounge by the water featuring silent disco, roller racing and food trucks. Find out more at lightthecity.sydney. City of Sydney, sponsors of 2SER 107.3.
You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. I'm Andrew Popel, of course. Now, I am joined on the line right now. This is fantastic to actually catch this author. And I've had people jealously attacking me about my review copy of Nevermore. Jessica is getting so much attention right now for Nevermore. And we've got this marvelous story, a fantastic world of adventure and danger discovered by Morrigan Crow as she flees for her life. But she's rescued by her mysterious benefactor, Jupiter North. So begins Nevermore, and we're thrust into an adventure with an unlikely new hero that so many people want to discover. Thank you for taking the time, Jessica.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I'm not even kidding. I have actually had quite a few people mugging me when they saw my copy, and they're like, I'm hearing so much about that. And I'm sort of like, that's really interesting. It only came out, I think this happened yesterday or the day before, it only came out a day ago. Your book is brand new. It is so exciting. And Morrigan Crow truly is an unlikely hero. It takes her most of the book to sort of even feel comfortable in her own skin, that she is among friends. She's plagued by sort of the anxiety that stems from her childhood. I just thought she was such a fantastic character for a young audience to explore. But I'm really curious what you were hoping her readers might discover in her.
Well, first of all, thank you. That's very kind. So Morrigan, when I was creating Morrigan, I wanted a heroine who felt real. You know, nobody wants a perfect child role model style heroine who doesn't feel like she could be a kid that you know. I mean, you're right, she is sort of plagued by anxiety. She has these worries through the book that are very real, like when you consider how she grew up, because she does grow up as this cursed child in her community who is blamed for everything, and she's really been conditioned to see herself in that way and to accept the blame for things that, you know, logically couldn't possibly be her fault.
And she's a kid. I mean, there's one point she makes a comment to her patron, Jupiter, that the whole world loves him, and he laughs and he says, your idea of what encompasses the whole world is quite different and maybe a little bit limited. And that's what kids have. Their whole world can be quite small, and she's been really negatively influenced by, the world that has made her whole world up until the beginning of Nevermore.
Right. And, I mean, that is that particular age as well. You know, she turns 11 at the beginning of the novel, and it is that age where your world is slowly creeping outwards. Morrigan, and that's like kind of writ large in Morrigan's story, because she does come from this very small, cloistered kind of existence in her hometown of Jacalfax, and then she is literally, you know, thrust into the into this colourful, magical city where things are dangerous and the world suddenly becomes so much bigger and more magical than she could have imagined. And that is kind of a version of what does happen around that age, because, you know, from my memory anyway, and from the kids that I know and my nieces and nephews, that is the age where you are starting to question things around you more and starting to question authority, and you're starting to realise that, you know, the world around you is bigger than just your immediate environment and your immediate family and friends.
And Nevermore is the place that Jupiter's spirits are off to save her life. Fantasy worlds really rely on the juxtaposition of their fantastical reality and the world that we know, or the world that's maybe the normal world. What was important for you in setting up both Nevermore and Jacalfax, the Republic, where Morrigan comes from?
I suppose that journey from Jacalfax or from the Winterthy Republic into Nevermore, it does take that typical kind of journey from essentially black and white, boring. Things are very structured and regimented and almost, you know, miserable for our protagonist, into this world of Technicolor. I mean, it's the same as Harry going from Privet Drive to Hogwarts, or Dorothy going from Kansas in sepia to Oz in Technicolor.
I was just thinking that, but maybe if Tim Burton had directed it.
Right, okay. Yeah, a little bit more macabre than Wizard of Oz.
And look, so the fantasy world is important, of course, but also the hero's entourage. We've talked a little bit about Morrigan, but a good fantasy hero needs an entourage. Everyone needs a Scooby gang. Do you want to tell us just a little bit maybe about Hawthorne, Jupiter, some of the people that Morrigan meets on the way?
Sure. So, I mean, that's the thing that Morrigan is seeking above all else in this story is, you know, her immediate goal is to get into the Wonder Society, but really in her heart of hearts, what she wants is family and friends and to feel like she belongs somewhere. And that's what she wants to get, you know, to get into the Wonder Society for. And so she does, you know, just like Dorothy finds the Scarecrow and the Lion and the Tin Men and so on, you know, she does find this family and this group of friends along the way. Hawthorne is one of my favorite characters. He's a little boy who is a dragon rider. And, you know, one of those kids who, I suppose, you know, if you didn't actually, he does have this great talent and great athleticism, but, you know, you wouldn't know it unless you actually saw him on the back of a dragon, because he is very much just, you know, a normal, goofy, funny, mischievous kid who likes to kind of cause trouble and, you know, and make fart jokes and all the sorts of things that 11-year-old boys love to do. So he is one of my favourite characters, and Jupiter as well is this, you know, I mean, we all sort of tend to kind of use tropes as useful shortcuts into a story, and Jupiter fits into that that mould of the wise mentor, I suppose, quote unquote. But he is also very eccentric and quite funny and sharp, and you know, he also has this quite sort of dark side to him that you do catch a little glimpse of sometimes when he feels protective of Morrigan, or when he's angry at people. And on the flip side, he's also a terrible adult. So.
Now, I'm a cat lover myself. Shout out to Winnie and Rocket at home. I'm assuming you're maybe living out a bit of a fantasy, giving Morrigan an outsized talking cat, Fenestra, to protect her.
Totally, yeah. So Fenestra, this cat who's about to, she must be 2 or 3 metres tall or something, this giant talking cat. I'm a cat person as well. I used to have a cat who was big, but, you know, not giant, unfortunately, called Hunter, and he was quite grumpy. So I always have a soft spot for grumpy characters in general. So, Fen is one of my favourite characters because she's kind of the snarky, lovable beast that I think we all secretly think that our own cats really are, if they could talk.
Now, the psychology of Nevermore intrigued me. Morrigan's main antagonist, really, throughout the book is her own fear and doubt in confronting the trials that she must face to get into the Wondrous Society. So you've got this society in Nevermore that are, it's very exclusive, very talented, kind of, well, led to believe wonderful people, although some of them don't seem quite so great. And Morrigan is told that she'll do it. She's assured by Jupiter, but she's constantly plagued by this doubt that she's not meant to be there. I'm fascinated by what young readers might make of this. Do you feel like, in reflecting this, that maybe childhood has become a lot of pressure for children?
Look, I never felt that way myself, and I did a lot of extracurriculars. But I mean, definitely there is this kind of, or at least in my, I mean, I wouldn't want to speak for other kids, but in this world that Morrigan lives in, or in this world that she enters, there are high stakes. It's very competitive. She is competing against hundreds of other children, you know, who all supposedly have these great talents. And I mean, for me, I didn't want the message of this book. I think it would be easy if you read a blurb of the book and you read that she's, you know, she needs a talent and she's competing to get into the society, that it would be a story about how, isn't it wonderful to have a talent and aren't all these kids great? And it's really, that's not the point for me of the story anyway, without sort of wanting to, I mean, it's not exactly a spoiler, but without wanting to kind of ruin the ending for anyone, you know, Morrigan does kind of come to grips eventually with the fact that, well, talent in fact is not the most important thing. There are other qualities that the society is testing for that are much more important.
I mentioned when we started chatting that I really enjoyed this book as an adult. Unfortunately, as an adult, I'm an adult. People keep telling me you've created a really interesting world to explore. I think kids are going to love it. I think that 10 to 13, that age that Morrigan is at the moment and is obviously going to grow in the books. But this is probably one, and we haven't even talked. I felt there was a real Aussie influence on this too, that really shines through. I think people are really going to get so much out of this series. Jessica, I know how busy you are. This book's about to blow up, and you've taken the time, you found the time to chat to me. I really appreciate that so much. I'm chatting with Jessica Townsend. Her new book is Nevermore. You're about to see it everywhere. Thanks again, Jessica.
Newtown Record Fair, your monthly vinyl record fair in the heart of Newtown, is back. Dig over 5,000 vinyl records from psych rock to electronica. Listen to live DJs, taste the tasty Cucina menu, sample craft beers on tap, all in a chilled out, family-friendly atmosphere. 2SER presents Newtown Record Fair, Saturday, November 4, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Bank Hotel, King Street, Newtown. NewtownRecordFair.com.au, a vinyl record-obsessed sponsor of 2SER.
Out of Canada, The Weather Station have returned with a self-titled album rolling with folk wisdom and rock punch. It's the 2SER feature album this week.
Gas came down from about 20, the joke was hell. It broke the economy.
The forecast is for this great album to be heard across Breakfast Drive and Static all week, where 2SER supporters can win copies.
I was on the sidewalk and you were in a tree. You said you couldn't stand it these days, your sensitivity.
The Weather Station, the feature album on 2SER 107.3.
The impossible.
Stories, ideas, music.
Good morning. You are tuned into 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft. I'm Andrew Popel, and I'm joined on the line by Chris Womersley. And it's been a few years since Chris and I last spoke about his novel Cairo. Today, though, we have a new novel to enjoy, City of Crows. And City of Crows takes us away to France. It takes us back in time. And Chris and I are going to delve and hopefully get some insights into it. Welcome back to Final Draft, Chris.
Thanks very much for having me on.
I'm excited to talk about this, particularly because of the historical era. But City of Crows, it broadly sits with historical events in France in the late 17th century. Charlotte Picot flees her village with her son following the death of her husband by the plague. They are waylaid and her son is kidnapped by traders who will sell him into servitude or worse. Charlotte is thrown into the path of Adam de Coulet by seemingly mystical means, and together they embark to Paris to rescue Nicholas. That's a great setup. I read that to myself and I'm like, I want to reread that book.
Oh, that's good.
And you weave your tale around historical events and figures, particularly those who dabbled in witchcraft and sorcery. And I wondered, was it this capacity for belief and the possibility of magic that attracted you to this era?
Yeah, that was certainly a big part of it. I mean, I've had elements of the occult in sort of all my novels, really, to a sort of a really small degree. And I guess I read a little bit about the 17th century and the fact that people kind of believed a bit more thoroughly in sort of witchcraft and sorcery than perhaps most of us do today. And it seemed like a good sort of environment for me to really sort of roll up my sleeves and get my hands dirty, as it were, like really sort of invest a bit more deeply in kind of elements of the occult and magic and stuff. And so I guess with City of Crows, it's a matter of the book's not a fantasy novel, although there's elements of the supernatural, and I guess my sort of way of telling the story is that I don't really ask the reader to believe in the supernatural so much as I ask them to believe, the characters believe in the supernatural, and therefore that's the way they kind of see how the world works.
What's it like psychologically to get yourself into that headspace of a population that were credulous to this?
Yeah, well, I was very sort of careful in writing City of Crows, actually, that I didn't treat... I think it's sort of necessary to treat the... always. I think you always have to treat your characters with a great deal of respect and kind of love or admiration, even if they're kind of, villainous, I guess, to a certain extent. And I was very careful with Charlotte and Lesage and all of the characters not to treat them as a sort of anthropological specimens. You know what I mean? Like, I think it was sort of, I mean, in reading about the period and stuff, and, you know, there's not a lot written about kind of, you know, the poor or working class or peasant class of the 17th century. But I think they're closer to us in their daily life in terms of their what they desire from the world than they are far from us. You know what I mean? Sort of like meeting a sort of a person from another continent who may look kind of on the surface incredibly different, but basically at heart they, you know, they fret about their children and they worry about, you know, what they're going to wear and what they're going to eat and stuff like that. Sort of our desires are more aligned than kind of not, I think.
I love reading books like City of Crows, but I feel like inevitably I start to look at them through a lens of our modern world. It's sort of, I feel like it's inevitable sometimes, especially when you read books closely. Was that something that you had in mind, or that you're happy to have City of Crows read as? Do you see reflections, or was it purely historical for you?
Oh, gee, it's actually a good question. Well, clearly I realise that the people who are reading it are 21st century readers and have a kind of particular worldview that is, at least for most of us, going to be at odds to a greater or lesser degree with kind of the way that people were viewing the world in the 17th century. But I guess it's about, you know, I guess in terms of kind of a modern theme or whatever, the book is about people who are denied power, who will use any means necessary to get it, I guess, even if it means kind of crossing to the dark side, as it were. So people who are sort of denied institutional power, who kind of might take whatever means is at their disposal in order to get some sense of control over their lives, which I think is sort of what magic was largely about, or certainly kind of in that period.
Yeah, because I just found enormous resonance. And when you say the description you just gave there, I think immediately, well, that resonates politically on both sides of the spectrum. So much of that going on. I'm gonna try not to to turn this into a modern novel by proxy, but I did have a few thoughts and
sure.
questions. So I thought I don't want to start asking you them and then have you go, actually, Andrew, it's a historical novel. You're reading too deeply. But for those of us that were either blessed or subjected to postmodernism at university, it's kind of inevitably, well, didn't you know, Chris, you're the author, so you're dead and I'm allowed to just read this however I want.
Well, and that's true. That's true too. Like, I do know people who are kind of, I've kind of met authors in my time who are very protective of the way people read their novels and stuff. And I'm sort of the opposite. I mean, clearly I want everyone to adore my work, but, you know, that's never going to happen for a start. And secondly, people just sort of bring to the table whatever, you know, the book sort of really only comes alive when a new imagination kind of takes hold of it, I guess, if you like. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And of course, this brings us to Charlotte Picot. She's very much your protagonist along with Adam, and her search for a son drives the narrative. But she's also, if I'm correct in thinking, she's also a wholly fictional character in the novel.
Yeah. She's pretty much the only one who's entirely fictional. And sort of as I was saying before, there's not a lot written about kind of peasant folk, especially peasant women. And to a degree, you know, she's the ideal. She's the ideal protagonist for somebody who, yeah, has been denied power, and especially without a man, without a brother or a husband, she has no kind of real, you know, at one point someone sort of said to her, well, what are you going to do? You can become a maid, or you can become a prostitute, or, you know, a thief or something, but there's not really a lot of options open to somebody like that. So there's a sort of the cell, as it were, that is made to her in order to kind of lure her into doing things that are probably contrary to her religious beliefs, is that she has very little other option, especially if she wants to try and find and save her son.
Yeah, I read a really strong feminist sensibility in Charlotte's emergence from her village. Then there's her education in mysticism by Madame Roland, who saves her, she's the witch of the forest, who really teaches her that a witch is just a woman with power, and her exercise of that power in Paris. Were you driven to explore these power dynamics in the novel, or did they just emerge by the virtue of the character?
Yeah, they just kind of emerged. Like, I think trying to write a novel with the thematic concern uppermost is sort of putting the cart before the horse often. Like, I think it's sort of most good books, or certainly stuff that I like to read and I like to write, has a character initially who's sort of put under some sort of pressure, and they're forced to make sort of decisions, I guess. And, you know, as I get, I guess as I was looking at ways in order to make Charlotte as a character cross over to doing things that she might not normally do, there was a sort of a proto-feminist argument put to her, or it was sort of a proposition of, yeah, along the lines, as I was just saying before, like, what else are you going to do, you know, like, and Charlotte sort of resists by saying, well, you know, I don't traffic in witchcraft, and the response is, yeah, well, what they call a witch is simply somebody with power, and, you know, it's certainly sort of true in that, and then this is 1673, so it's not long after the, you know, the big period of the witch trials was sort of 1550 to 1650, pretty much, although it still kind of continued afterwards. So there's a sort of element of people who are kind of outsiders and who have no other recourse to power other than kind of using sort of supernatural or, you know, quasi-supernatural means, and it's a way of keeping people, you know, powerless.
Yeah, I was also interested, though, in the way that that power, however it is situated in a person, then leads to influence and control. And it made me wonder about how this reflects on our modern era, because ultimately the City of Crows works for the reader, or it worked for me, based on my relatability and my ability to reflect. And the way Adam Lesage is very much an interesting character study in this. He feels that he has duped many people. He doesn't really believe in his own tricks, but then when they're applied to him by Charlotte, and later on in the book there's a monk preaching who seems to have a moment where he has Adam in his crosshairs, and Adam then interprets and allows both Charlotte and the monk to have power over him because of this need to believe, this need to cite power in an individual who might control us. And yeah, it got me really thinking about this modern era where we do tend to deify. Sports people are a great example. They have their superstitions, but we then deify them and want to follow them, no matter what the ending.
Yeah, that's actually kind of a really good point. Like, I think we all have within us that sort of need or desire to, I don't know, or not all of us, because it's, you know, people who seek that power, but we like seek to kind of, yeah, you're right, cite power in something that's external to us, and there's a sort of a guiding force, if you like, whether it's a sort of a moral guiding force or political or ideological or indeed, of course, religious, you know, it's sort of a way of, and I don't know how to explain that other than it seems sort of inherent in our kind of human nature that we are a sort of a, we're kind of worshipful as a species, perhaps, you know what I mean? Like, we sort of, I mean, you know, except for those who are kind of, you know, the narcissists who don't seek to worship anything except, you know, but to be worshipped, I guess. Yeah, you're right. Like, it's, you know, and that's another thing that interested me about Lesage, is he sort of, or, you know, in the way that I've kind of imagined him and created him, is that he believes in magic and the supernatural, but he's sort of mildly tormented by the fact that he's never really been able to access it himself to as much as he would like.
And if you would like to know more, we are discussing City of Crows. I'm speaking with Chris Womersley. It is his latest novel set in 17th century France. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time on Final Draft to discuss what's a really fantastic historical novel, but as I think emerged in my discussion of it with you, has some really interesting resonances for the modern reader.
Oh, thanks so much for the chat.
And that is it. It is almost time for me to say goodbye. You are tuned in to Final Draft on 2SER 107.3. I'm Andrew Popel. I have less than a minute left. The Vulture's Nest is coming up next. Stay tuned for those guys. They are awesome. A fantastic take on the week's events. I want to say thank you again to Chris Womersley and also to Jessica Townsend for discussing their books. Thank you to everyone listening for being here and engaging in discussions around literature. It is so important to our culture, and I love being able to present it every week. My name is Andrew Popel. You have been tuned in to Final Draft. Stay tuned on 2SER. That's a great. I love Saturday programming. Dirt Music, Vulture's Nest, so hot right now. I will be listening to them all, and I will be back next week on your radio for more books, writing, and literary culture on Final Draft. See you then.